Africa.
Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, October 10th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Russia and China want the U.S. to tone down the rhetoric over North Korea.
Military options are on the table with North Korea. They absolutely are.
Efforts to defuse tensions with Turkey over strict U.S. immigration policy continues. The Trump administration is looking to reverse an Obama-era clean power plant policy. Also ahead, the controversy over America's Columbus Day holiday. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump said Monday that previous U.S. attempts to deal with North Korea have failed for more than two decades. Trump's new remarks were his latest hint that he could upend longstanding U.S. policy aimed at containing North Korea's nuclear weapons development short of confrontation. He also implied in a tweet over the weekend that only one thing will work. Budget Director Mick Mulvaney said it should be pretty clear what the president meant.
What the president's clearly telegraphing, and this should not be news to anybody, is that military options are on the table with North Korea. They absolutely are.
While following the weekend warning that hinted at military action, Russia and China Monday called for restraint over North Korea's missile and nuclear programs. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Robert Manning, senior fellow at Brent Scowcroft Center for International Security at the Atlantic Council.
I think they're both legitimate. I would throw in the concerns from the Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which are quite similar. Trump's tweets are counterproductive and raising tensions unnecessarily. And I think they're counterproductive in another way, in the sense that I'm getting the impression that both North Korea and China are viewing Trump as a kind of a paper tiger, that he keeps saying these things and North Korea keeps doing its tests and not much happens. And similarly on China, you know, Trump threatened trade sanctions and tariffs and all this stuff and hasn't done much. And so I think there's a real issue here with how serious is the president and how serious are other countries taking him. I think that's becoming a real issue. The currency of great power is credibility. If that starts to erode, you're in trouble.
Speaking of tweets, the president on Monday said our country has been unsuccessfully dealing with North Korea for 25 years, giving billions of dollars and getting nothing. Policy didn't work. Does he have a point?
He has a point, but is it the fault of the policy or is it the result of North Korean ambitions? That's a legitimate question. The notion that every problem has a solution in the time frame that we desire is an American conceit. And I think that North Korea is one of those problems from hell that are very difficult. And I don't, you know, Trump has a point. We've come close a couple of times. I think the Bush administration, working with China and the six-party talks, put together a very thoughtful agreement that offered North Korea just about anything they could want: energy aid, economic aid, normalization of relations, peace treaties, and so on. And they walked away from it. So is that Bush's fault, or is that North Korea deciding they'd rather have nuclear weapons than normal relationship with the rest of the world?
As you probably know, Kim Jong-un on the weekend told a leadership conference in Pyongyang that the nuclear program is a powerful deterrent to U.S. imperialists. Obviously, this is something that they view very importantly.
Well, that's the other dimension of Trump's behavior being counterproductive, that the last thing you want to tell somebody who's getting nuclear, they're getting nuclear weapons because they're afraid the Americans are attacked. So how does it help us? How does it help Secretary Tillerson in his diplomacy that is designed to put pressure on North Korea to denuclearize if Trump is essentially threatening war? That just makes North Korea's nuclear weapons more valuable to them. So it's fairly dumb on almost any level you want to place it.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis told an Army conference Monday to be ready with military options on North Korea, but also emphasized efforts to deal with Pyongyang are being led diplomatically. He said there's one thing the U.S. Army can do, and that is You have got to be ready to ensure that we have military options that our president can employ if needed. We currently are in a diplomatically led effort, and how many times have you seen the UN Security Council vote unanimously now twice in a row to impose strong sanctions on North Korea?
Well, I would agree with Secretary Mattis. I think, look, the job of the military is to plan for contingencies. That's their job. So there's nothing unusual or worrying about that. And we've been planning for contingencies on North Korea for many, many years. And the problem is being made worse when Secretary Tillerson is in Beijing asking for trying to convince China to tighten the screws on North Korea and cooperate more. It doesn't help when Trump starts tweeting that it's a waste of his time. This is really behavior that undermines Trump's own foreign policy, and it's hard to understand this as the behavior of a rational actor.
That's Robert Manning, senior fellow at Brent Scowcroft Center for International Security at the Atlantic Council. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Girls in South Sudan are less likely to go to school, according to a new report. The death toll jumps to 10 as wildfires burn deep into California's wine country. IS is depriving thousands of children of education in an Afghan province. And Moscow, escalation of tensions on the Korean Peninsula, unacceptable. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, Turkey on Monday urged the United States to reverse its temporary halt to non-immigrant visa applications, a move that was quickly mirrored by Turkey the day before. The Turkish Foreign Ministry summoned the U.S. Embassy's deputy chief on Monday to urge Washington to reverse its decision, saying it's causing unnecessary tension and has caused harm to Turkish financial markets. International Edition's Sarah Williams spoke with reporter Dorian Jones in Istanbul about an arrest warrant for a second worker at the U.S. consulate.
The Istanbul Prosecutor's Office has announced that they want to interview another employee, a local employee working at the Istanbul consulate. That would be the second person that would be detained in connection with last year's failed coup. The Prosecutor's Office has also confirmed that they have detained this person, the suspect's wife and son. And we understand that, according to some media reports, that the person wanted is taking refuge in the Istanbul consulate, although that hasn't been confirmed. But there's indication, despite the severe pushback by Washington over the detention of one of its employees last week, the Ankara and the judicials and prosecution service are continuing with their investigations.
Well, now, in regard to the sort of the visa shutdown or the stoppage of that, I mean, that is affecting Turkey's financial status as well.
It certainly is. This came as a big shock to the financial markets. The Turkish lira fell heavily, as did the stock market. And that is an indication of how deep the concern is with this rising tensions with the United States. Up until now, there was this hope that they could be confined to behind the scenes. There have been simmering tensions for more than a year since the failed coup attempt. But now that it is out in the open, with both sides taking sanctions against the other, has caused alarm in the financial markets. And there is a deep concern going forward what the financial as well as the political and diplomatic implications of these rising tensions will be.
And what has generated this latest standoff between the two countries? You know, of course, there was the coup, the failed coup. But this, it seems like it has just simmered tremendously just in the last week.
Well, indeed, this has been a long time coming. I mean, ever since the failed coup attempt, and there was a lot of anger in Ankara that they felt that Washington didn't come to Turkey's aid quickly enough. And there was even suspicions voiced by some ministers in the government claiming there was some involvement in the U.S. by the U.S. in that failed coup, although that was strongly denied by Washington. But those suspicions have been going on for some time. Within the pro-government media, you regularly hear reports accusing Washington of being involved in the coup attempt. And the fact that remains that, according to Ankara, the architect of that coup, Fethullah Gulen, lives in the United States. He's a Turkish Islamic cleric. Ankara is demanding his extradition. Washington insists that is a matter for the courts. But that has been a major point of tension between Ankara and Washington. And feeding into that, beyond that, there's also anger that Washington is supporting a Syrian Kurdish militia in its fight against the Islamic State. Ankara accuses that militia of being linked to the PKK, which is a terrorist organization, according to the United States and the European Union. And this is also feeding into this wider feeling of distrust. They are NATO allies, but for well over a year, there has been this growing distrust between the two allies. Up until now, that has been confined to behind the scenes, but now it is in the public domain. And the big concern is, where does everything go from now?
All right, that's reporter Dorian Jones in Istanbul. Well, Columbus Day is a national holiday in America, a day set aside to honor the Genoan, who is credited with discovering the Americas through pluck and seamanship, and to celebrate the heritage of Italian Americans along the way. But many Native Americans say that Columbus's heroic reputation contradicts the historical reality of the man whom they say brutalized and exploited indigenous peoples for gold and labor and initiated centuries of conquest and genocide. They seek to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke to people on both sides of the Christopher Columbus controversy.
Many Americans agree that Christopher Columbus was a genius as a seaman. With a flotilla of three tub-like ships paid for by King Ferdinand and Queen Isabel of Spain, he set sail in uncharted seas bound for the riches of the East. He landed in the Bahamas instead. Italian-American community leader Jude Anthony Ciscornia says his heroic qualities deserve to be honored with a national holiday.
That's part of what it is to be American, that ingenuity, thinking outside the box, being the first to do something, thinking forward, thinking ahead, doing something no one else is willing to do, doing something everyone else is too scared to do. That's what Columbus embodied. Why do people say he's a monster?
Because of what Columbus did after he arrived in the so-called New World, says Native American activist Dennis Robert Jennings.
He was a kidnapper. He was a murderer. He was a greedy warmonger. And he really exemplified sort of a personality of Europe for the historical time that said that all the rest of the world were theirs.
According to Columbus's own log, he and his sailors were met with hospitality and wonderment by the Arawak villagers who had lived on the islands for millennia. Columbus had been promised the governorship of any newfound lands, plus 10% of the profits. That was news to Native American rights activist John Curl, a Caucasian, who, like other Americans, had been taught in school that Columbus was a hero. As an adult, Curl read a magazine article about Columbus's edict requiring every Native American to pay him a monthly tribute in gold or have his hands cut off.
It just blew my mind. I knew nothing about this. And it turned out there really was not that much gold there. Because he didn't have enough gold, he started rounding up Indians and selling them back to Spain to be sold into slavery. So this is the man who invented the transatlantic slave trade.
But Jude Anthony Discornia says he doubts Columbus himself enslaved the native peoples.
I know he tried to convert him to Catholicism, which any Christian European person would have done at that time. It would have been almost illegal to go into what was considered a savage land and not try to Christianize these people. And it was only a matter of time. If Columbus didn't do it, there would have been some other European within 100 years in the 1500s that would have wound his way over there and did the same thing.
Dennis Robert Jennings does not speculate about what could have happened had Columbus not come, nor does he romanticize the native cultures Columbus encountered. But in helping to create Indigenous Peoples Day in 1992, he says he wanted Americans to know the full story. And he adds that the darker side of Columbus's legacy continues today with corporate exploitation of native lands and environmental destruction.
We really did want to try to change people's consciousness about this whole perspective of greed and what is mine, mine, mine. We didn't want to think about it in terms of this is something that happened a long time ago. This continues to happen today in Guatemala, in Mexico, in El Salvador, Brazil, in places that there are tribal people. The people are worth nothing, and the resources of the land are worth everything.
So far, only a handful of U.S. municipalities have officially renamed Columbus Day Indigenous Peoples Day. Differing views of Columbus's legacy continue to polarize people, both in their communities and in the international arena. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
and you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Environmental groups are outraged over the Trump administration's intention to overturn an Obama-era plan to slash greenhouse gas emissions blamed for global warming. Environmental Protection Agency head Scott Pruitt announced Monday he will scrap the Clean Power Plan, declaring the war on coal is over. Joining me now to discuss is David Doniger, director of the Climate and Clean Air Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. What do you make of this?
Well, what he's going to do is propose to repeal the regulation. He doesn't withdraw from it. It's an EPA regulation established by the Obama team. And, yes, he says he's going to propose repeal.
So, in other words, it can't just happen. It's just a proposal.
It has to go through the same process, tear it down, as it took to build it up. And that means very rigorous requirements for legal justification and explanation of all your factual propositions and court for them. And then when he issues a final decision, whenever that is, there'll be a court challenge.
So are you saying it has to go through public hearings? It has to go through some steps before it can actually be reversed? Yeah. But is he able to reverse it on his own?
He thinks he is. We think he's wrong on the law, and we think he's cooking the books on the science and on the economics. The head of an agency like the EPA has to follow the Clean Air Act in this case, and he has to follow the rules about how regulations are made and unmade, which is basically you have to follow the law and you have to have evidence to support what you're claiming.
Mm-hmm.
And those claims get tested first when he issues a proposal, and then the public gets the opportunity to comment on it, to react to it, and you build a record. They make a final decision and respond to your comments, and then the issues go before court.
So this needs to go through the courts before it can actually be reversed?
He could reverse it, and then we get to challenge it in court. And
okay,
that's court,
it, yeah.
The court can block it or undo it.
Mm-hmm. You said he's trying he's attempting to cook the books and change the science. What do you mean?
Well, so the original Clean Power Plan is built on a very powerful scientific and economic record. It shows, first of all, that the carbon pollution is causing a very large amount of damage, and so is the other pollution that comes from the same plants, soot and smog pollution. And what EPA did was calculate how much difference the rule would make in the pollution coming from the electric sector and put a dollar value on it and compare it to the cost. Benefit-cost analysis was hugely beneficial, like 50-something billion dollars a year in benefit against under $10 billion a year in cost. Now, this is a problem for Pruitt because the right has been claiming that it ain't so. So he's jiggering all the numbers in the cost-benefit analysis. For example, there is an estimate of the value of curbing the carbon pollution, hundreds of millions of tons of carbon pollution. And what the previous administration said is that's worth about almost $50 a ton when you take into account the damage that's done not only in the United States but all around the world, and the damage that's done to our children and grandchildren because this pollution hangs around for hundreds of years. So what Pruitt is doing is saying, I don't care about the damage done to anybody but in the United States, and I don't care about the damage being done in the future. So he's changing the analysis to radically cut back how much benefit there's estimated to be because he's excluding the harms outside our country and he's excluding the harms that fall on our children and grandchildren. So that's cooking the books. Pruitt is going to just change the assumptions for how that work is done without going through any science review and present numbers that basically assume that there's a safe level below which there's no harm and write off all the harm that previously was estimated to occur from pollution levels below the level that without any scientific advice, he's just deeming the threshold.
Do you have any idea why he's so dead set on reversing all of these?
To ask that question about Trump, I mean, there is deep-seated denial that climate change is a real problem with it. These pollution problems are real problems. They're sucking up to actually quite a narrow band of the polluters and the purveyors of the dirtiest fuels and playing to an anti-governmental base. Trump did that to get elected. I suspect Scott Pruitt does the same thing because he wants to get elected. He's often thought to be ready to run for governor of his state or senator from his state. The power industry executives, mostly, they get it that the climate change problem isn't going away. And they also know the Clean Air Act, the law of the land, is not going to get changed. So these problems and these laws are going to outlast President Trump and Administrator Pruitt. And these executives need to make decisions that are going to govern what they build and what they operate for more than the next 3 years. They're making longer-term decisions. They know that the current rightward swing here is just not going to last. Hmm. And they're making decisions to stick with at least some degree of change away from high pollution sources. They just continue to move, maybe not as fast as I would like, but they're continuing to move. Nobody's building new coal plants, and the coal jobs are not coming back. That's another thing about what Trump and Pruitt are selling. They're selling false hope to the miners and the people in coal country. If you really wanted to help those parts of the country, you got to help them get into the clean energy economy, because it's wind and solar and energy efficiency and clean tech that's growing. That's where the jobs are. And we have a clean power plan. What Trump and Pruitt are giving us is a dirty power plan. And that's not what the public wants.
All right. That's David Doniger, director of the Climate and Clean Air Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. And finally, we turn to our social media segment with Andrew Palchevsky. So, hey, Andrew, what's going on?
The story that we've been talking about for weeks, we're still talking about it. Russian interference in the U.S. presidential election on social media. And this story is only growing because, as we've been talking about, it happened on Facebook with ads, it happened on Twitter, and now we're getting word that it happened on Google and YouTube. Tens of thousands of dollars reportedly spent on content, including YouTube videos, YouTube ads, Google ads, all aimed at influencing opinions during the election. This news comes from the Washington Post, who said that this is coming out for the first time that this has impacted Google. The ads are from Russian-linked groups. It's not clear whether those groups are the same ones that purchased ads on Facebook. It mm-hmm. might be a different group. They might be legitimate ads, they say mm-hmm. even. But this is something that they're going to have to investigate. And as we learn more about these ads and these efforts, the scope just grows. And this is evidence of that. Google has not put out any statement yet as to this, but I'm willing to bet they will be addressing this. They will be speaking out and explaining what these ads are. We might be seeing some of these ads or some of these YouTube videos in the coming days and weeks. And certainly by November 1st, when Google, Facebook, and Twitter have to testify on Capitol Hill about the interference.
Unbelievable, just the scope of this thing that, you know, they really targeted every angle they could.
Absolutely. And even within Facebook, which we've talked about for weeks, if not months, there's still new information coming out. Oxford University's Project on Computational Propaganda says that some of the fake content and some of the propaganda content on Facebook was targeted towards U.S. veterans and active military members trying to influence their opinions using conservative alt-right information. Mm. This goes in line with what we've seen that Russian groups have targeted, whether it's racial groups or military groups or other demographics. It's very broad in scope. At the same time, it's very specific in terms of who they've targeted. So, and this is only the beginning. We're going to see more. As I've said over the past few weeks, we're only going to see more of this come to light.
Unbelievable. Okay. Well, anything else?
Yes. Other than Russian interference on social media, Facebook and Google, it's always a challenge to try to reach people on social media, and sometimes it can backfire. And that was the case for Dove, which is a brand of soap and lotions that falls under the company Unilever. Mm-hmm. They posted an ad on Facebook that showed a number of different women pulling a shirt over their head and revealing another woman underneath wearing a shirt. And in this case of this ad that caused controversy, it was an African-American woman. And as she pulled this shirt over her head, underneath was a white woman. And people are claiming that this seemed to symbolize using Dove products, cleaning away race. There's been a stereotype or a trope of African-Americans being unclean and white being pure, and the white race being pure. So this was what people took from this ad on social media. Now, to Dove's credit, they did pull the ad down, and they said that they're committed to representing diversity. They missed the mark on this ad, and they deeply regret the offense that it has caused.
Wow.
So they did come out and apologize for that. But sometimes when you try to market on social media, you can hit the wrong notes. And Dove certainly did here. Touching a racial nerve for sure. Mm-hmm. One that a lot of people were talking about on social media.
All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States will continue its long tradition of welcoming and caring for refugees. During fiscal year 2018, the U.S. government has proposed admitting up to 45,000 refugees from Africa, 19,000, East Asia, 5,000, Europe and Central Asia, 2,000, Latin America and Caribbean, 1,500, Near East and South Asia, 17,500. The new limit of 45,000 refugees is lower than in recent years. It takes into account a number of factors: the security of the American people, the government's capacity to properly vet the refugees according to its enhanced security procedures, and the backlog of hundreds of thousands of asylum cases the Department of Homeland Security currently faces from people who have already come into the United States and are seeking protection. Since 1975, the U.S. has welcomed more than 3 million refugees. With the new ceiling limit, the United States will continue to permanently resettle more refugees than any other country and will keep offering protection to the most vulnerable of those who have been persecuted because of race, ethnicity, political opinion, nationality, religion, or membership in a particular social group. It is also important to note that refugee resettlement is only one part of the U.S.'s response to the global crisis of forced displacement. The U.S. remains the world's leading donor of humanitarian assistance, providing over $7 billion last year. During the 2017 fiscal year, the U.S. provided more than $1.4 billion in humanitarian assistance for the Syria crisis and more than $581 million for Iraq. In addition, the U.S. has given nearly $2.5 billion for people from countries facing famine and nearly $104 million for displaced persons in Burma and the region. We are also the number one contributor to the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and continue to be the leading donor to other agencies to provide life-saving support for refugees and conflict victims, including the Red Cross, Movement, the World Food Program, UNICEF, and a wide range of non-governmental humanitarian organizations. This support provides vital assistance to refugees and conflict victims close to their home countries, with the view to enabling refugees to return to their homes voluntarily and in safety when conditions permit. The United States takes pride in its humanitarian efforts and goals and will continue to care for people around the world who are fleeing violence and persecution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.